Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, and welcome back to the Rosslare podcast. Today we tune into Mick Wallace and Claire Daly's podcast, I Foresee Trouble, where they discuss the in-depth happenings in the European Parliament. They're also talking about vaccine passports and the EU's insistence on exporting banned pesticides to third world countries. Finally, they discuss Lisbon and Portugal's role in the European Parliament.
Today's episode, we're going to talk about what's been happening during the week, a bit on vaccines, a bit on environment, and Portugal is our pit stop for the week. So we'll go into what the Portuguese MEPs are like in the European Parliament, which I know you're dying to hear about. But let's kick off with vaccines, the biggest topic and most important thing at the moment. So what are the developments? There's this new digital certificate.
Yeah, I mean, that was a huge one this week, was the Commission causing consternation and literally provoking thousands and thousands and thousands of emails from worried citizens as a result of this announcement that there was going to be this vaccine passport. Now, it was being put forward as sort of in the context of allowing society to reopen, have safe travel and all of that. And we're all obviously keen for that to happen. But the idea of a vaccine passport where travel would be allowed on the basis of the production of a passport which said that you'd been vaccinated is highly sketchy.
And they're not calling it a passport. No. You're not allowed to say the
in
word
fairness
passport.
To, in fairness to the Commission, I think they realise that that would be just completely unacceptable. Yeah. And the proposal is actually that the production of a document which says that you have been either had your PCR test, so you can show a negative test, or you can show that you've been vaccinated, or you can show that you had COVID, might help in opening up the situation. Now, the problem is that they're pushing through an urgency procedure, which we voted against, but we were only in a minority of, there was about 200 and something against, 400 plus, just to push this through without further debate. And it is worrying because, first of all, and it's true to say, and the WHO has even said it, the scientific evidence hasn't been concluded on this. So we don't know even, the vaccinated person is only protected themselves. The evidence isn't there that a vaccinated person can't contaminate somebody else. Mm. They don't know whether that is the case. They don't know whether the vaccines will protect against future strains. And then, of course, the slow pace of vaccine delivery means that the huge bulk of the world's population wouldn't be allowed to come into Europe if you were to do this. And yet, you know, they seem to be pushing ahead with some documents. So I think it's been misrepresented in the media a bit. A lot of people were really panicking, thinking that this was coming in overnight and you wouldn't be able to travel. That's not the case. But we really need to be vigilant on this, because the idea of governments gathering that information and using it for purposes, a health document, is really scary stuff. And I think against the backdrop of the aims they're making of the COVID restrictions at home, people are really worried, and rightly so. So now the procedure will go ahead and they'll look at developing this, but I think they'll have problems with
honest. What's the real purpose of it then, in the end of the day? Like for the Commission to be doing this?
Well, they're putting it forward, they say, to, you know, allow society to open up and all that kind of thing. But people are rightly sceptical that, you know, this could lead to sort of data being misused, fundamental rights being undermined, and, you know, people who would otherwise be able to come to the European Union being prevented from doing so. I think that's a bit down the road myself. But these things, when they're brought in under exceptional grounds of a crisis, have a tendency to become the norm. And that's where people should be worried.
Yeah, and a big problem is, I mean, people are well aware of the fact that you can spend 5, 10, 20 years fighting for rights, and then they can disappear overnight in a parliament. And that's the big fear. And with regard to a passport vaccine, I mean, we've heard the Fianna Fáil members, one of them anyway, in the parliament, calling for a vaccine passport. Billy did call for it, and Billy Kelleher. And I mean, that's scary. Like, I mean, if the chances of it not infringing on the freedoms and liberties of some of the population would be zero, because people have the right to get to avail of the vaccine when it's available to them, and they have the right not to take it. But another problem is the fact that if something like this came in, what happens to the 130 countries that haven't got one vaccine yet? Mm. Will they be stopped from moving around the place? Mm. Will they be barred from coming into Europe? We're already engaging in vaccine apartheid. And I actually spoke on it this week, where it's been revealed by the European Observatory, which we spoke on last week, but more information came out on it. And in actual fact, there was not one of the 27 members opposed restricting the lifting of the waiver to allow poor countries to make their own vaccine. They're not even asking, they're not asking for it for nothing. They want the right to make it for themselves, to lift the intellectual property rights so that they can make it. And the whole of Europe is saying no. Why? In God's name, how are we going to get rid of COVID if we're going to stop, if we're going to make it more difficult for the poor countries to vaccinate? Do they think that we can get Europe vaccine or COVID free and let the rest of the world have it? Do they think that's going to work? They're not well done.
But you see, and I think it's real lazy journalism that the media aren't focusing on that. And I think it's partly lazy journalism on the issue you were saying, like Billy Keller getting huge publicity for saying, oh, a vaccine passport. The Taoiseach, in answering Michael Lowry actually in the Dáil the other day, said something similar. Having a vaccine, proving you've been vaccinated, is going to be a key to people being allowed to travel again. That's not true. It's actually unlawful under EU law that something like that could happen. And the European Commission, we might give out, aren't even proposing that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yet the Irish government are kind of putting it forward as if it is, in the same way as they put forward the tracing app thing, as if it's a kind of magic wand. They'd be better off now doing their job in terms of bringing in more coherent regulations and dealing with COVID and the vaccine distribution rather than coming
but
out with this
it.
Nonsense.
Like, is it actually an excuse for not rolling out the vaccine fast enough? Is it because there's been such a hang with rolling out the vaccine that we're fiddling with this idea,
like it's in, yeah.
Do you know? So yeah. It's kind of to make up for that almost.
A bit of a distraction, yeah. Probably. Yeah,
new show
and,
on town.
I mean, we had more of it as well this week. I mean, we had Eimear Cook, the head of the European Medicines Agency, before the Parliament at an NV committee, and I got a chance to ask her a few questions. But before she came in. In the last couple of days, the chair of of EMA, the European Medicines Agency, the chair said that the idea of using Sputnik V, the Russian vaccine, and for any country to use the emergency authorization facility, which means that you can actually use it without actually waiting for it to be approved by EMA, she says, would be like playing Russian roulette. But yet, at the same time, that's exactly what the UK did. Mm. And the EMA did not object to the UK doing it. And then we had Commissioner Thierry Breton, the French guy, the far right wing fellow, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. He came out and he said, the last thing we need now is a Russian vaccine. Mm. Mate, give me a break.
A load of member states don't agree because they're all buying it.
Yeah.
He has, so the only problem he has with the Sputnik vaccine, because by all accounts, it's of a high quality. So his problem is not that it's a vaccine, but it's Russian. Mm. I mean, God help us. Do we want to save the lives or not? And as I put it to Eimear Cook, given that only 12%, and we're almost at the 1st of April, only 12% of the European population have been vaccinated yet, and we're getting picky about what vaccine we use. Mother of God.
Unreal.
Anyway, that's your vaccine update for this week. Let's move on to some other things. Claire, there was a vote this week in the plenary on dual use items. I think that's always a head scratch for some people. So maybe
God, it's always so depressing. So these are, and we used to raise this in the Dáil an awful lot about Irish involvement in, because actually, believe it or not, there is arms production in Ireland, quite a lot of it. And some of it comes under the heading of dual use. So that's something which could have a military use, but also they say is primarily civilian or whatever. So they need to be monitored and treated differently. So there's been kind of long running negotiations to get an EU regulation in this area and to tighten it up a bit. And look, it's actually quite boring and quite technical. The regulation that they put together is a bit better. It's a little bit tighter. There's more transparency and monitoring in terms of where these products are going, who they're being sold to, and all the rest. But I mean, one of the clauses in it, I mean, you'd welcome it, but then at the same time you'd say, are these people for real? Like, that there's a clause in it, like, whereby they'd say that there's an obligation to expand the declaration of a situation if somebody is purchasing dual use for use in internal repression or for the subversion of for serious human rights abuses or international law violations. Like, I can't imagine someone going into a shop or filling out the invoice and saying, yeah, I'm getting using these now for a bit of internal repression and a bit of civil rights violations. Is that okay? Okay, declare that there, Bernard, and you'll be grand. Like, it's absolute nonsense. But look, the key issue with this is, again, it's typical EU hypocrisy. And they got up today and fell over themselves going on about China and Russia being involved in these things when the EU itself has been selling these products to the apartheid state of Israel and to Saudi Arabia. We're the second biggest exporter of arms to Saudi Arabia and UAE, who've been using them to kill people in Yemen. We have obviously the ongoing sales all the time and really close cooperation with Israel for the real military use, not to mind the dual use ones. So, like, hypocrisy. And yet they're all getting up and saying, oh, we've vindicated human rights today. We've done a really great job in a transparent document. And it's an okay document, but yeah, let's get real about it.
Which leads us on to more human rights. And they have been losing the run of themselves this week in attacking China. And some interesting developments on it.
Well, yeah, tell the people what happened this week.
Well, first of all, they introduced sanctions against some Chinese people in the Xinjiang area, where the big controversy is about the Uyghurs.
The first thing to say is that only since December do we have a new sanctioning mechanism in the EU called the Magnitsky Act. It's replicating the US one to do these so-called targeted sanctions where you're picking individuals and all for human rights abuses. So this is the big welcomed tool that everyone's cheering about that we finally have. It's been adopted in the council and this is the first time being put to use. So it was against some Chinese officials.
Oh yeah, and yeah. What you need to understand is that when it comes to human rights in the European Parliament, they're very interested in some human rights and they're not very interested in other ones. I mean, a very clear example of it was for example, they loved to give out about human rights in Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua, but then they don't like to talk about them in Chile or Colombia. So it depends on whether they're friendly with the government of the day or not. Likewise, it's okay to cut off at least 30 heads a month in Saudi Arabia, but we do a lot of business with them, so that's okay. We haven't had
an urgency resolution on them yet, have
no,
we?
No, there's no problem with human rights in Saudi Arabia, seemingly, even though by all accounts research, is probably one of the worst places in the world for women to live. And we won't even get into the goings on with Afghanistan, where they're almost pretending that everything is grand because the government is working with them. And I mean, the fucking wheels are coming off in the place, and the Taliban are probably getting stronger since the Americans went in there 20 years ago.
Tell us about the sanctions this week, though. So,
the Chinese were on the receiving end of sanctions under this new procedure that you described, and the Chinese decided to react, and they sanctioned back.
Which is normal in these cases.
Shocker. God, yeah,
my God. That's the normal way it works.
They selected five individuals and they selected the subcommittee on human rights draw. And the European Parliament is aghast.
But I mean, to see the reaction of them, I mean, I think the Chinese were a bit silly in that these people are nobody. Like, some of the people, you hadn't even heard of them on the list. And really, all they do is they're in here just to criticise the Chinese. Like, this was the best thing that ever happened, them being sanctioned.
But yeah, you know, and what I mean? We say it's a sanction. And what it really means is that they can't
free
go
publicity.
They can't go to China for the time being. And they can't do business in China as if they were already doing business there. So it's really symbolic thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's really interesting that they've sanctioned the Droit Committee, as you said, which is a human rights committee, because it's a subcommittee of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the European Parliament. And they're the ones responsible every month for preparing these resolutions on human rights, which, as you said, are highly instrumentalized. And you have resolutions on Vietnam and poor Vietnam getting a slap on the wrist. And you don't have one that's happening on Saudi Arabia. So it's interesting. And that will mean that they probably won't be able to do a mission to China anytime soon. Now, the rest of the parliament will. There's an NV environment mission to China in October for a biodiversity hearing. But like, it's just to make the point that, look, it's tit for tat if you're going to play these kind of games. So interesting developments, though, with the sanctions mechanism, because you've been critical of it from the start. There was not much discussion about it as well. It just came in through the council. They thought it was going to solve the world and get human rights everywhere. Human rights to all, thrown around.
We've been making the point for the last 2 years almost that if you're going to talk about human rights, let's apply the same rules to everybody. And if the Palestinians are being wiped off their land and their land being stolen off them by the Israelis on a daily basis, and Palestinians have been killed, we should talk about it just the same. So we either talk about none of them or we talk about all of them, but we treat them all the same. And if Israel is carrying out, is running an apartheid state in Israel, which it is, and if they're attempting a genocide against the people of Palestine, let's call it as it is. And then we listen to the problems that you have evidence of in places like China as well.
But also, it's not even just selective of where the human rights are that we care about. It's what ones as well. And you've made this point before, Mick, on the podcast about how socioeconomic rights are actually systematically ignored.
So, well, we've never had a session in here where we look at the example of the huge stride forward that the Chinese economy has had in terms of eliminating poverty, which nowhere else has done in the globe, and it has been sort of spearheaded by their state-led policy. And that's not to say that we think China is a perfect country. We don't. We don't think anywhere is a perfect country. Utopia sadly doesn't exist, but they've made great stride forward. So why wouldn't we discuss the positive examples? And I suppose one of the positive examples we had this week is we had a great meeting, a webinar, because obviously we can't meet anybody now, with the person who is likely to be, we hope, the new Ecuadorian president, if the West doesn't get its way in terms of a Bolivia-type coup. Well, then Andreas Arauz, who is the front runner following from the first round of the Ecuadorian presidential elections. The next election is round two, is on the 11th of April, I think, isn't it?
It is the 11th of April.
And he hosted, or we were participants in a webinar that members of the Ecuadorian Parliament organised with colleagues around Europe. Jeremy Corbyn, other people were at it as well from the German Parliament and all the rest. And it was really good. And they were basically looking for the antidote of the international hostility, international solidarity. And they were reaching out to parliamentarians around the world to assist them in their election process, in overseeing and ensuring what happened in Bolivia, where there was a coup against the wishes of Bolivian people, isn't replicated in Ecuador. And they made the point about a lot of use of political interference, of lawfare, of the judicial systems and the political systems being used in a partisan way against, to try and block the will of the people. But he was a really impressive guy, wasn't he, Mick? And we really liked him. A young man, a young economist.
Yeah, he's only 36.
Down to earth. Great guy.
Lovely. He seemed as decent as anything. And it'd be great if there's no interference and he actually wins.
Yeah.
But and he spoke a lot about the social challenges in Ecuador and the point that you made, Damien, about the fact that the likes of health and education and housing are actually human rights. And 3 months ago, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights, when talking about the sanctions in Syria, said openly, and it was great to hear it because you don't hear it very often, she said that it's shocking the manner in which the human rights of Syrian population are being denied to them by these sanctions. She says they have the human right to housing, to healthcare, to safety, and She says the sanctions are denying them that, and she says they are illegal.
It's gas. I mean, and the other one of the other UN special rapporteurs made the point about, say, repressive legislation in France, that this is targeting Muslims. The terrorist laws are basically have turned the Muslim population in France into a suspect community. So these violations are going on all the time. But yet we say, oh, we're the defenders of human rights, when they go ahead really without any commentary. It's really shocking.
Let's move on to the environment. Mick, you had a few things to say as well during the week. One was on pesticides and the export of pesticides that are illegal in Europe, right?
Yeah, so. I mean, people might think that you've been making this up, right? But there's 270 pesticides and chemicals illegal in Europe now, but you can export them.
Yeah, so now, they're produced here.
They're produced here. They're allowing the European companies to continue to make money on them and sell them to other people. And at the I got a chance to discuss this as well at the committee this week, at the Environment Committee, and there was people expressing concern. Are you not worried, or put to the Commission, are you not worried that these harmful pesticides could actually come back in food that we're going to eat, that we're going
That's
to import?
So
now, there was no concern about the population in the global south that were actually consuming these foods that were being treated with chemicals that we have banned. And it should be pointed out that Europe has a commitment to get rid of at least 50% of all the dangerous ones left before 2030. Get rid of 50%? You know, we're going to consume 50% of the dangerous chemicals after 2030? And we're only getting rid of some of them now. We've got rid of the real worst of them, but there's loads of them still need to get rid of. But here we are exporting the very worst of them and endangering the health of the people in those countries. And on top of that, we talk about the biodiversity loss. We talk about the near extinction of pollinators. The decline in pollinators across the world is dramatic. It is off the Richter scale. And these pesticides are contributing to global decline of pollinators. And what are we doing about it? As long as the chemical companies can make money out of it, we will continue to help the decline of the pollinators.
Well, I'm wondering, why is this discussed in the Environment Committee and not the Human Rights Committee? Because it's clearly a human rights issue.
Exactly.
Exporting dangerous chemicals that people are spraying, getting Parkinson's disease and all sorts of horrible diseases on the ground and the environment, which is destroying the place for generations to come, destroying their food. It does get back to us as well, which is part of it. But like, it's actually a huge human rights abuse in the global south, and we don't even seem to care. Do you know, the fact that it's even allowed to happen and that there's been such a glaring inconsistency there just shows you that it's kind of inbuilt into the system here, that big business is well protected, that they're able to export these very dangerous chemicals. And there's already dangerous chemicals, as you said, in Europe, in our own food. And I think people need to know a lot more about that as well. And we're authorizing them as we go. Like, this is where the authorizations happen for chemicals, is at an EU level. And it's actually pretty bad here. But when we're talking about exporting even worse ones abroad, like, it's just hypocritical.
But they'll get up and give great speeches about colonialism and how, you know, progress and how we've changed and all of that. But it's just, this is the new form of it, you know?
It's mad that it's actually directly linked to the vaccine issue. My last question to the Commission on the pesticide thing was, I said, is it not true that we are protecting the profits of these chemical companies at the expense of the public health of the people in the global south? Is that true or not? And he refused to answer the question. But so not only are we poisoning them with our pesticides that are not good enough for us to use anymore, they're just so bad that we've banned them, but we're prepared to sell them, make them and sell them to them. And at the same time then, we won't lift the intellectual property rights on the production of the vaccine to allow these poor countries to make their own vaccine, because we are protecting the profits of the pharmaceutical industry in Europe.
It's just mad.
They don't want to challenge authority, and you know, that's the way in every walk of life. And I mean, we got a chance again this week to champion the cause of one of the most famous, I suppose, people who have challenged authority, Julian Assange, who still remains incarcerated in Belmarsh. And we're just very happy, both of us, to be participating in a ratcheting up of the campaign to try and secure his release. We were delighted to see that a number of colleagues in the Dáil have been taking up the issue. That's great. There's been sort of lightning talks organised on it, mixed participating in an event soon as well. So, again, we'd like to just constantly remind our listeners to not forget about Julian.
Yeah, who's a political prisoner who's in prison for telling the truth.
Yeah.
Like, so I think it always needs to be mentioned, because we talk about political prisoners or journalists in prison in other parts of the world who are actually in prison for saying some awful things and really doing some really bad things. So
I mean, we discussed today about the murder of Daphne Galloway, the Maltese woman. A journalist who was killed, and that was a horrific murder. But we forget that Julian is in prison, and one of the things he's in prison for was the collateral murder video, which documented the murder of journalists and that as well. So, you know, he's in prison for highlighting the murder of journalists.
Yeah.
And it's just...
And I have yet to hear a serious debate about the treatment of Julian Assange, his human rights in the European Parliament. But maybe it's coming.
I think we need to make a few proposals to the Human Rights Committee about subjects.
Given that they'll probably be a time on their hands now, they won't be dealing with China as much.
Anyway, time to hop on the 2-2 train. We're going on an interrail trip. This time we're zipping all the way over to Lisbon, Lisboa. E vamos falar em português desta parte do podcast.
I
love Portugal and I love Portuguese, so I'll refrain.
There's nothing as bad as a South dub showing off how many languages he owns that he can speak.
Go on, tell
I've
me.
Never been to Portugal, so you better talk about Portugal, Mick.
I'm sure you know plenty about it too, but yeah, I've been to Portugal a few times, and for some strange reason it was always linked to football. Now, you might find that's unusual, but I went to the European Championships in 2004, and I went for 14 or 15 days first, but in 14 days I went to 14 games, and I had one of my sons with me, and it was a great experience. I absolutely loved it. It's a country I like very much. I've been back a few times for individual games, and anytime I was in Lisbon or any of the other places, I've always felt a real good feel to the place, and I'd be very comfortable in the place. I would.
Well, tell me what you've learned about Portugal in the European Parliament. How many MEPs do they have? What groups are they in?
They have 21 MEPs. So they're kind of one of those kind of middle of the road countries, you know, not in the small town camp, but they're influential enough. I suppose we know them a lot because there's four of them in our group. So they make up 10% of the left group, which is quite influential. I suppose made more influential that they're divided in half. Half of them come from the Portuguese Communist Party and half of them come from the Bloco, the left Bloco, as they're called. And like any good left organisation, or in our experience in Ireland, their biggest enemies probably are themselves. There is a very strong dynamic of rivalry between them. We'll call it healthy rivalry, but I'd be lying. But they're very influential, and we'll give out prizes for guessing which one we get on with most. But anyway, I suppose what is interesting is that is a strong left current, though. You know, the left is the smallest group in the parliament. They have four MEPs in it. Yeah. That's not insignificant. Yeah. It reflects something about Portuguese society. What's also reflected is that there's a very weak green voice there. So what you have is environmental activists and that obviously vote left or more radical.
And they're
radical
actually in
left.
Alliance. The Greens in Portugal are in alliance with the Portuguese Communist Party. Mm. And the people might be like, for people like in Ireland, where we associate green movements with the most liberal right-wing kind of politics, in Portugal, it's a very different story. They see it very much as an anti-capitalist thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think it probably comes out of the fact that they were a dictatorship up to the, you know, early mid-70s. There's always been a very strong communist party there and workers activist tradition, which actually has its mark on the country and their delegations. I mean, the other people, so they don't have any Greens or any of those sort of woolly sort of people. They don't really have any Liberals either. Yeah. They've none, which I think is a great credit to the Portuguese people, that there's not a, not a single member of the Renew group or the ID group or the ECR group.
Well,
is there?
Maybe there's not, ECR. But actually we had presidential elections recently in Portugal. And there was a load of left-wing candidates. As you say, it's a very left-leaning country. But they have the same right-wing president, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, who is a centre-right kind of person. But the elections were interesting because it was the first time the far-right actually gained ground, which is a disturbing development now in Portugal, because they've been one to hold fort now for a long time. But this kind of opened the doorways there for the far-right to make their
and that, point. A lot of that was kind of on the back of COVID and that as well. I think it is certainly one to watch.
Okay, but we also need to make the point. I mean, the Portuguese were a colonial power, and it really struck home to me when the Portuguese, who presently have the presidency
of
the European Union, and when the different ministers came before us, and there was a guy in at Foreign Affairs, there was a guy in at Environment that I actually got a chance to quiz him on some stuff. And he came in to CEDA as well, right? And we had a Foreign Affairs minister and we had a Defence minister. But I put it to them, right, about where was their main area of interest during their term of the presidency. And they said Africa. So, and I started digging a bit, right? And I discovered that Portugal still has a lot of colonial interest in Africa. And it hasn't, colonialism might have ended, and these people were supposed to have got their freedom in the early 1960s. But
in the case of Portugal.
And that's really valid point. And I think that kind of defines them. It's that divide, like, between their colonial past, their dictatorship past, their radical past, that gives them that sort of character. So you would say they have a presence here. I mean, the ones I've come across, there's a few middle-of-the-road ones in the socialists and in the EPP group. They're competent, nice people, capable. So they're kind of unlike, you know, when we were talking about Austria last, that didn't really make a mark. I'd say the Portuguese
all work very hard, I'd say.
I mean, the things what we learned about the country, because it's not a country I know much about. They make nice wine. Yeah, they don't really have anybody famous. Like, once we said, we asked the lads in our office, tell us somebody's famous from Portugal, and they came up with Nelly Furtado, like, for God's sake.
Seriously.
Well, speaking of wine, I would argue that a bit like the Spanish, they keep their best wine for themselves, and that's not a crime.
How about Cristiano Ronaldo?
Exactly. Good point. Yeah.
Fernando Pessoa, who's a fantastic writer.
That's true.
Luis de Camões, who's a very famous writer as well. Some fantastic music as well. They have the Fajo music.
Well, I thought was interesting is that
the president of the UN is Portuguese.
No, but what's really.
You didn't mention Eusebio.
Yeah.
I mean, probably an even. Probably an even bigger favourite in Portugal than Cristiano Ronaldo is at the moment. And Luis Figo was in between the two of them. But the three of them have been, world-class players. And probably at some stage, all three of them were probably considered the best player in the world for some period of their sporting life. But, I mean, that's for a small country to produce Eusebio, Figo and Ronaldo... Not bad going.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting about them was, and she's obviously we saw Damien trying to show off at the start, but that Portuguese is the official language in 9 countries, which is interesting because you don't think of them as a colonial power, but the big one is Brazil.
Exactly.
The big one is Brazil, which is huge, which has kept them going. All the others are kind of...
That really emphasises their colonial
nature. No, of course it does, but people forget that, you know. But
A big important language worldwide as well. Lots going on there. They have really good food.
Yeah.
Great place for fish.
Yeah, they're actually mad into their bacalhau, their cod. But it's funny because if you say cod to them, it means salted cod. It's always salted because that's how they preserve it. And the reason they have this is because not because they have any caught in their water.
They come in and rob it for most, probably.
They actually rob it. It's a historical thing because they have an alliance with England for years and years and years, centuries. And England used to guarantee them access to waters near Canada, which is where they could get caught.
So they were colonialist friends.
I know, I'm telling you. But people think that, I'm in Portugal and by the sea, I'll have a bit of salted cod. It's not nowhere near coming from the Portuguese waters. So it's from way up north. But it's just a historic thing that they caught.
We like the Portuguese. We're giving them a high rating.
Now people, someone got on to me last week and said, you know what? You've been very negative about those countries in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And you've given them a hard time and you're probably a bit unfair to them. And here we are now, we're doing our first country in Western Europe and we're kind of being as nice as...
No, it's what you call Austria, got the worst rate.
Central.
They're Central Europe. Yeah. They were never considered Western Europe. And you know what? The Eastern Europe now can happen as well.
Well, yeah, might as well. What are they getting out of the 10? Now, we're talking about the MEPs. In the European Parliament, the Portuguese impact in the European Union. Out of 10.
I know a good half of them now I haven't heard of at all. Like, you know, I'd give them a 6 or 7, you know, the ones I've come across on the committees I'm on.
Well, given that, I mean, the only ones I only really know are the ones in GUI. They're all, I would say, pretty active, all four of them. I've probably not been fair to all. I mean, I suppose it depends on what committee you're
exactly,
on, right?
Yeah,
I probably just haven't had a lot of them on my committee. Although now that I think of it, there is a guy on foreign affairs, and he's actually not bad, and he's Portuguese.
They're very pleasant, generally. And
so
I mean,
thumbs up
across
for Portugal.
The political
well
groups,
done.
Yeah.
Let's pick our country for next week, Claire. You go and pick it there, out of the hat.
It's France. Vive la France.
Right,
I don't think so.
Right to Europe now with this one.
Now,
so
we'll be talking plenty about colonialism next week.
Now
our special episode.
Friend can see how we treat Western countries if he thinks we don't like the Eastern ones.
A special episode on colonialism.
I'll tell you what, we might have to do two programmes on France.
Yes, I think that's true.
Dedicate the whole episode to France. Okay,
right.
Anyway, happy Easter.
Oh, it's my dad's birthday and I wanted to wish him a happy birthday. He listens to every podcast and he's 65 today, so...
Happy birthday
to you.
Squash tomatoes and stew.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Jamie's father. Happy
Colin.
Birthday to you, Colin.
Thanks,
well, listen,
Colin, for everything.
Colin, you're nearly as old as Mick now. Fair play to you.
I had the pleasure of your company over a meal in the Italian Quarter once, and I'm looking forward to a time when we can do it again. But I have to say, now that I've got to know Damien a bit better, I think you're responsible for a bit now. And I'll tell you what, we have a bit of raring to do when I'm still. Good luck.
Anyway, happy birthday, Dad. See ya.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank MEPs Mick Wallace and Claire Daly, and host Damien Thompson for the use of this material. Keep on listening to TRP.